This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Osteothera plus Ipraflavone from Claire Labs. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus Ipraflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And today's podcast is all about integrative gastroenterology because we have a rare species of doctor here on the line with us. She is an integrative gastroenterologist. In fact, she is the only integrative gastroenterologist in New York City, which is quite a distinction. That makes her about as rare as a unicorn. Because well, there are probably about 40, 50, 60,000 doctors in New York City. And she is the sole integrative gastroenterologist for New York. And so we expect to hear from her about her insights into natural approaches to GI problems. In fact, if you go to her website, which is ManhattanIntegrativeGI.com, her motto, which is borrowed from the physician philosopher Maimonides, and I'm quoting, is no disease that can be treated by diet should be treated any other way. And that's a wonderful starting point for integrative gastroenterology. She's Dr. Alexandra Shastina, and in my mind, her greatest claim to fame is that she went to Stuyvesant High School, which if you're if you're a New Yorker, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. Your parents must have been very proud of you because it's the most competitive academic high school in New York. And then she went on to get advanced training. She is a board-certified gastroenterologist. She's trained in osteopathic medicine. She's a DO, Doctor of Osteopathy. And she actually brings to bear some of her training in osteopathic medicine, which is quite an interesting perspective that I think a lot of people don't hear about. So she also has a faculty position teaching gastroenterology to young doctors in a Columbia University affiliate. So she is hospital affiliated, although she has a private practice here in New York City. Alexandra, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
I thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, Ronald.
Okay. Well, first of all, how did you move towards an integrative approach in gastroenterology? Was that something you were thinking of from the get-go, or did you find yourself stymied and frustrated by the limited tools of gastroenterology, and then you opted to go for a more integrative approach?
Well, I guess kind of both. As a child, I had lots of allergies. And my mother always took me to all the alternative non-doctors. So I was very, very open-minded about that. And that's the kind of care I really looked for myself and my family. But I wanted to be a doctor since I was three. So for me, being a doctor was meant, prescribing medications and doing procedures and working in a hospital. So those two kind of were discrete things. Like, this is what I did for me and this is what I think I should do for everybody else. And then I got very sick between my residency and my fellowship with horrible allergies. And I was
so really often happens, you know, the stresses of academic training really take a toll on your health. It's kind of a time where you don't prioritize lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I did my residency at St. Vincent's Hospital, which, as you know, closed. And it closed 2 months before I graduated.
Oh, goodness.
So, yeah. It was a very stressful point in my life, and my allergies were crazy, and that's when I really started learning a lot more about integrative medicine and lifestyle and diet, and that really helped me a lot. So then I went into my training, and into my GI training, and the GI training is 3 years. The first 2 years, you're just kind of scrambling and trying to figure out endoscopy and it's very challenging. And then in my third year, when things kind of started coming together, I started realizing I'm not helping probably about half my patients. And there were a lot of patients in our practice that were labeled as irritable bowel, which from my understanding is about 20% of the population have some kind of functional disorder. And it's probably close to half of a gastroenterologist practice. So they were labeled as problem patients and difficult patients, and we weren't really helping them. And I felt like there are other things that I could do that helped me that I wasn't able to do within that structure. So that's when I kind of knew I couldn't continue in that way. And that was the trigger.
Were you surprised by, in your training, the lack of an integrative or holistic or even just nutrition and diet-oriented perspective? Because, I mean, after all, we're talking about the gut, the digestive tract, and it would stand to reason that, I mean, if your toilet gets clogged and the plumber comes by and says, hey, lady, what'd you throw down the toilet? Right. They're usually going to, that's the first question they're going to ask. But a gastroenterologist, may not even be talking to you too much about diet.
So it's funny that you say that, because I feel like every person who's not a doctor would ask that question, because it makes complete, perfect logical sense. But when you go into training, gastroenterology is such a specialized field with so many procedures, and the focus is really on procedures, that you kind of have blinders on. And I think that's where a lot of people get lost in looking at the perspective from a holistic picture. So on one hand, it seems quite logical to involve diet into a gastroenterologist practice, but it just logically, it just doesn't work out that way with the type of training that we receive. And we do have some nutritional training, but usually that's more like, critical care nutrition, IV nutrition, the tube feeds and things like that. But it's really not what we mean in about nutrition in the integrative functional world.
Indeed. And, part of the paradigm is a heavy reliance on a certain few drugs. For example, proton pump inhibitors. It seems like the field of gastroenterology is infatuated with Nexium, Prilosec, and things along those lines. And how effective are they? And, what are some of the downsides?
So it's interesting. Everyone was on them. Probably there were I would probably say that it's definitely the most prescribed drug that we used, but it probably was one of the most prescribed drugs that anyone ever used, because once you had a little bit of discomfort, they put you on Prilosec and you never came off. Is it effective? A lot of times it is effective for treating the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And some people did get better with reflux or gastritis.
Yeah. It's almost a test to see if you have inflammation.
Exactly.
To save you the time and expense and suffering of getting an endoscopy, doctors will just prescribe some proton pump inhibitors. Take these for a month or 6 weeks to see if you're better. And if indeed you're better, then it was, GERD or it was, gastritis. And so much the better. Patient's happy, problem solved. So it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. We called it a PPI trial. I mean, it's right. A real thing. There's a lot more data coming out that these medications that we thought were literally the safest things in the world and had, only positive things to add and no side effects, we're learning more and more about the C. diff and the osteoporosis and the dementia and cardiac disease and everything that we're seeing increased rates of in patients who've used them long term.
And most recently, a study saying that they increase the rate of depression. In fact, there was some statistic by extrapolation. They estimated that 14% of patients with depression who are on PPIs could have their depression alleviated. That would be, perhaps hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
Isn't that interesting? Because we have an idea of why that happens with the microbiome and how it's so, closely correlated with mood and the mind function. But I guess the conventional community is now starting to catch up a little bit. And I know some of my residents are now a little bit hesitant to put patients on PPIs. There's that thought process before that never existed. you know, just even a few years ago. So I think we're catching up to the fact that, hey, maybe they're not so safe. But it's, we still have a long way to go because we don't really have great options.
Exactly. Other than perhaps natural options, which, you know, may require a lot of effort. You know, some patients just want to take a pill, you know, so it does require the extraordinary patient, a patient who may seek out a practice like yours, to go that extra mile, change their diet, take various supplements, which sometimes aren't covered by medical insurance. So it's, you know, it's almost like two-tiered medicine, you know, it's the medicine of the quick fixes for them that are not interested in changing their diet or, you know, paying out of pocket. And then there's, you know, a more, perhaps more gratifying, but less of a mainstream route, look, using natural approaches.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it's just a small suggestion, even, you know, when I teach clinic in the hospital with my residents, sometimes, you know, I just tell them like some basic lifestyle things that are helpful and no one really discusses it with them because it's much easier to give a PPI and it's also, that's what's tested on their boards. So, you know, that's the first thing that comes to mind. And right. Sometimes it, you know, some of the lifestyle changes are complex and sometimes they're just very basic. And I see if they, you know, sometimes they can be very effective.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you're in a teaching position at a medical center and you're exposed to young doctors and you actually have sort of a dual mandate. On the one hand, you want to teach them to be good doctors, but on the other hand, they need to answer questions on a very stringent board exam and they better come up with the right answer. I mean, if they check the box, you know, use aloe vera, you know, they're going to flunk the exam, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I wear two hats. And, you know, I push it to the limit, but I, in the hospital, but there's just so much I can do. And I, you know, that's within my job description. So I do try to, you know, sometimes have residents think outside the box, the ones who are interested. And, but, you know, there's really so much I can do that's outside of standard of care in a hospital setting where I also have such short time with the patients. I actually have even shorter time in a clinic setting because I'm just basically supervising the residents. So, you know, it's certainly very limited, but I do try to educate. And some of my residents actually follow me on social media because they're interested in, or sometimes it's because they have their own medical issues that they're interested in. But
well, I hope that some of them will tune into this podcast because I think they'll find it inspirational. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors to share this important message with you. Here goes. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. This is Dr. Ronald Hoppen with a comprehensive formulation that supports optimal bone density to ensure your future bone health. It's Osteothera plus Ipraflavone from Claire Labs. Osteothera plus Ipraflavone helps inhibit bone resorption and promotes new bone formation. The Osteothera plus Ipraflavone formulation is vital for supporting the body in the formation and regeneration of bone to ensure your optimal skeletal health. I believe in Osteothera plus Ipraflavone so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, and I recommend it to my patients. For more information and to purchase Osteothera plus Ipraflavone, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. And now back to today's guest, integrative gastroenterologist, Dr. Alexandra Shostina. So, you know, unfortunately, GI medicine has succumbed to the find a bug, use a drug approach that is so much an element of conventional medicine. For example, the focus on H. pylori. H. pylori is something that we discovered, thanks to Barry Marshall, is implicated in the causation of ulcers. He actually drank a vial of H. pylori, gave himself an ulcer. He was a pioneer in that respect, N of one. And then he cured himself with antibiotics, and that was a convincing demonstration that H. pylori had something to do with it. But now, there's a trend for some gastroenterologists to test for H. pylori, and once they find it, to prescribe powerful antibiotics along with acid blockers to treat it. Have you signed on with that approach, or do you find it lacking?
So it depends where. So in my practice, that is certainly not my first approach. But in the hospital, it is. We do test for it quite a bit, and we in certain populations, it's very, very prevalent. So it, people who come from South America, Africa, Eastern Europe, we see it like probably one of the most common diagnoses I've seen. And I've also seen it very resistant to even first line and even second line therapy, which is conventional antibiotic therapy. So now these bugs have become resistant, mm-hmm. which we see with everything when we overuse antibiotics. But you know, in my practice, I see it as a manifestation of a total body digestive dysfunction, and which is associated with dysbiosis anywhere else. And in a sense, it's like an organism that overgrew because we allowed it to, since we don't have enough of the good organisms and enough of the proper function of the digestive tract and the immune system.
And in fact, some studies suggest that H. pylori is not just a mistake of nature, that actually it may have some beneficial or protective functions. So by eradicating it, we may get rid of one problem, trade it in for others.
Right, certainly. Makes sense.
So another issue that has now surfaced in conventional gastroenterology, a very popular notion, but it's a notion that dates back, predates the discovery of this by conventional gastroenterologists, which is SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. Many years ago, we used to call this candida or the yeast connection or dysbiosis, as you mentioned earlier. And I think it's rocketed into popularity because we have a seeming quick fix for it, which is the medication Xifaxan. How effective is that medication? I mean, I've used it, and I think it helps, but long-term, I think you need to do more than just give people a two-week prescription for medication.
So when I've used it, it's exactly my impression. It worked for a short period of time while the person was on it and for a short period of time afterwards, and they always came back. I've never had a situation where I treated someone with Xifaxan once and they had lasting relief.
Yeah, so, I mean, what it's generally used for is something called IBSD. Can you talk about the different kinds of IBS and what some of the approaches might be to that?
Sure. So IBS, or irritable bowel syndrome, is really a syndrome of symptoms that we call irritable bowel as a diagnosis of exclusion. Basically, it's not everything else that we know how to diagnose, and therefore it's irritable bowel. So there are certain criteria for irritable bowel, and it has to do with pain, bloating, and then there's several different types, which is diarrhea predominant, constipation predominant, or mixed. So typically, when someone presents with some chronic symptoms, which are bloating, incomplete evacuation of stool, pain relieved with a bowel movement, and abnormal bowel movements, whether it's diarrhea, constipation, or alternating, which mm-hmm. we see as well, they get some kind of testing for it based on their age. So if it's a young female with diarrhea, for example, we would probably, this is purely conventional guidelines. We would test them maybe for celiac disease, because there is some association with celiac disease and irritable bowel.
Just celiac disease, but it's thought that even some people who are non-celiac folks, they're not allergic to the gluten. They're sensitive to the fructans in the wheat, which is part of the FODMAP diet elimination. You get rid of that's the F in the FODMAP, that when you eliminate those foods.
So there is definitely a component of irritable bowel that is diet triggered. And a lot of it is emotionally triggered, and we already know that there's an association of depression, anxiety, and sexual abuse. But the way I like to look at it is that it's really not one disorder. It's really just something. It's called irritable bowel because we don't have a great mm-hmm. name for it, but it's really many different things. Yep. It could be SIBO, it could be food allergies, it could be leaky gut. So it's just a conglomerate of different digestive symptoms that we kind of labeled as one thing. And the truth is that it's very poorly treated conventionally. It's very ineffective. So because the treatment for it is not a medication.
Mm-hmm. Well, the treatment for it, unfortunately, sometimes is, medications that are sort of bowel tranquilizers. And I guess they work to some extent, but they have side effects.
Right. Right. So, there are certainly some medications that are used, like antispasmodics for the pain, or medications that are for diarrhea, or medications that can help promote bowel movements in those that are constipated. Mm-hmm. But usually, that's usually treating the symptom of the issue, when the issue is really something goes much more closer to the source of the problem.
Alexandra, I want to pick your brains about some of these new constipation medications, because, we have a whole lot of people in America who are constipated, and some don't, frankly, respond to a high-fiber diet. I mean, in a simple maneuver, you say to people, hey, well, eat some fiber, have some salad, have some whole grains, or, take some psyllium, take some flax seeds, whatever. But these people just simply, they have motility problems. They just can't move their bowels. And it is a terrible problem, because some people, maybe they become laxative dependent. They've used, things that contain Cascara Sagrada for so many years that they can't go to the bathroom without them. So what intrigues me, and, because I'm not a gastroenterologist, I don't want to touch them because they're brand new medications, and I'm not familiar with them. But there are these medications that promise to deliver results in the extremely constipated. I mean, not just the ordinary run-of-the-mill constipated, but very constipated individuals. What's your take on those drugs?
So I'm assuming you're talking about things like Linzess.
Yes, because I see ads for them on TV, and they're heavily promoted in medical journals. So are they good? Are they safe? Do they work?
So I've had mixed results. I don't prescribe them in my practice at all, but I do have, some patients that are on them, and I have prescribed them in the hospital-based mm-hmm. practice and in my training. So they do work sometimes, and sometimes they don't work. I haven't had any serious side effects with them. I think, like most laxatives, once they start taking them, it's hard to get off of them, even if they're effective initially. Eventually the motility of the body, of the gut, becomes dependent on it in a sense. Yeah. And they really can't have a bowel movement afterwards, and it becomes a really chronic treatment rather than a kind of a short-term treatment to help the person actually start having bowel movements on their own. So I don't really prescribe them. They are used, and they're used with mixed results. Like, for example, today I just had a patient who came in with a type of irritable bowel type picture with constipation, with severe constipation, and Linzess didn't work for her at all.
Wow.
And she is on now on a lot of natural products, which do work for her, but she wants to get off of them and try to have bowel movements on her own. So what I found actually that to be extremely effective is visceral manipulation.
Wow.
Because that actually targets the motility.
And that's an osteopathic notion. That's actually something from your osteopathic training. Many osteopaths, they take the training and they say, thank you very much. Now I'm qualified to be a physician. And they kind of forget about it and don't harness it in their professional practices. But you harken back to your training in osteopathic medicine to utilize these techniques.
Yeah, I went back to my roots. But the truth is I was really one of those doctors that really poo-pooed it, who was, it was just kind of like a means to get a medical degree. But I did learn some of these things, and I didn't really integrate them until after, when I trained in more depth. But they really work. And so visceral manipulation is actually, developed by a French doctor, Jean-Pierre Borel, who actually won like Time Magazine's like one top physicians one year. And it basically targets exactly what we just discussed. It almost takes organs that are stuck, that there's some kind of restriction in their motility and mobility, and it mobilizes them. So I've seen it really work very effectively on these type of disorders.
And there are some people who suffer from SIBO, and you give them herbs, you give them medications, and the SIBO always comes back. And the problem is a problem of dysmotility, And so is it possible to rekindle the peristalsis, the natural flow of the GI tract from mouth to anus using the visceral manipulation?
Certainly. I mean, I think it's certainly possible. There's some situations where it's extremely difficult. For example, if someone's on narcotics,
yeah,
and then they're taking that consistently, and that certainly affects the motility profoundly. So something like that might be very difficult. You know, patients with severe neurologic disorders, although it can certainly improve things, but in general, I find it to be extremely effective. The question is, how long does it take? So some people respond very quickly, some people it takes longer, but it's usually a combination effort with everything else. You know, if they're on a bad diet, you know, it's going to take a lot more manipulating to get them to feel better than if it's a, you know, an approach from multiple different directions with diet and natural supplements that are needed and stress management and sleep and all those important things that go into overall health and digestive health. And then that is just another thing that we can introduce to help them.
So you're actually one of these rare physicians who actually touch their patients. Oh, what a novel concept. You know, you're not just staring into the electronic medical record and typing out prescriptions. That's a plus in your favor, and certainly for your patients. Dr. Alexandra Shastina is a integrative gastroenterologist, and we divide these podcasts into two parts. So in part two, we'll talk about specific supplements, and we'll talk about some other aspects of GI disease. In particular, we're going to talk about inflammatory bowel disease, ulcerative colitis, and Crohn's disease. Big problem. The drugs that are designated for that work to some extent, but they're not curative. So we'll approach that subject in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.